We are in the fourth week of an eight-week series called Love Versus. It's kind of a play on words. We get creative sometimes. That we're looking at 1 Corinthians 13, which is full of verses in the Bible, verses of the Bible, talking about love. But it's also verses in the sense of a fight, because what Paul is doing is laying out contrasting values. He's saying, love is these things, love is not these things. And over the last few weeks, we've seen that love is not status, love is not hostility, love is not envy. And this week, we're looking at pride. Love versus pride. And as a pastoral staff, as we were trying to decide who is best equipped to deal with this topic, oops. You know, one of the fun things about what we're doing today, diving into pride, that's all of us, isn't it? Like every one of us has somewhere, somehow, something that our pride gets the best of us. The other day, Zach Hayes, who works with me in a student ministry, we were in the gym working on something, and we started playing a song while we were doing it, you know, great worshipful stuff as we do. So I'm going to be 500 miles. And he started belting it out at the wrong time. And I laughed. I was so sassy. I was like, you don't know. And I ripped into him, blah, 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 blah. Like, this is a big, long intro. And then to show him, I waited for the time where it's actually supposed to start. And I started belting it. And I was also early. Zach was so satisfied and disappointed nobody was there. But now we all know. Pride gets to us all. You know, and sometimes it's goofy, but sometimes it's very dangerous. And one of the things that we want to clarify before we really start to go into this, right, is there's different types of pride. There's a pride that is healthy, right? The satisfaction in doing what we're supposed to do, the pride that we have when we see our child succeeding in something, and that God talks about in the book of Job. He boasts about his servant Job, right? That he has this pride in his servant. There's a little bit of a sense that there can be a pride that builds up and a pride that tears down. And that's what we're going to dive into today. When Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 13 at the end of verse 4 into the beginning of verse 5, love is not boastful or proud or rude. He's talking about this kind of tearing down pride. Now the temptation when we talk about pride, especially on a topic like this, is that we're really good at identifying it in other people. Right? That I'm going to say some things today, and there will be a temptation to go, man, I hope my wife is listening to this. I hope my son is paying attention. I wish my mother-in-law was... Oh, wait. Hey, Laurel. We're really good at recognizing the sin of pride in other people, aren't we? And we have blinders to ourselves. And so one of my opening challenges to you as we dive into this a little bit today, that's not what today is for at all. Right? To resist the temptation to think of how other people should be doing something about this, because this is for us each individually. Let God work in your heart where pride is in your life that needs to be rooted out and dealt with. N.T. Wright, talking about this passage in 1 Corinthians 13, I love his words about it, because this part of a verse is part of a bigger passage, right? And N.T. Wright wrote, "Finally and climactically, we come to love." Think of the wonderful poem that we call 1 Corinthians 13. The poem itself is complete and exquisite. It's this incredible, beautiful essay on what love is and is not. Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 7, this is just part of it. "If I could speak all the languages of earth and angels, but didn't love others, I would only be a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I had the gift of prophecy, and I understood all of God's secret plans and possessed all knowledge, and if I had such faith that I could move mountains but didn't love others, I would be nothing. If I gave everything I have to the poor and even sacrificed my body, I could boast about it. But if I didn't love others, I would have gained nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. It does not demand its own way. It's not irritable. It keeps no record of being wrong. It does not rejoice about injustice, but rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Love never gives up, never loses. Faith is always hopeful and endures through every circumstance." So what you might not realize is there's two conflicting views on what it means to be a follower of God going on in the Corinthian church. That throughout this letter, Paul is addressing ways in which this church is not demonstrating the love that Christ has called them to demonstrate. That it seems to be that the Corinthians have this sense of following God means, man, they know all the right stuff and they know all the right words. But Paul's going, you don't have any love. That Christ came and paid the ultimate sacrifice so that we could emulate him. That Paul is calling them out. And what we might not realize when we just isolate this one passage, but in the picture of all of 1 Corinthians, here's what Paul is doing. He's going, look, love is this, this, and this. And then when he lists those negative things, he's essentially going, love is not you. He's going, love is not the way you're acting. All of these things he's listing off are things that he addresses in his letter to them of going, you are doing these things. And that is not what it is to follow God. You are known for all of these negative words today, and specifically for being boastful and proud and rude. He was like, that is not what it is to follow God. He's essentially going, hey, you claim to be great Christians because you can talk like a Christian at the right times and you dress right and you show up at the right thing and you know all the right words. But man, there is something wrong going on in your heart. The love that should be marking you is not there. And he goes, and if I'm trying to describe what a Christian is not, the easiest thing to do is to point at you, is what Paul is saying here. And I think the challenge for us is that we're not as different from the Corinthians as we would like to believe. That a lot of the same things they struggled with then, we struggle with today. He writes, love is not boastful or proud or rude. And when Paul wrote those words, there was a little bit more, some of the depth of the meaning there is different, 2,000 words, than some of the, we can just assume we're reading it, well, this is what it plainly says, but this was written in another language, in another culture, in another place 2,000 years ago. And so there's some nuances to it that sometimes we miss. So when he writes this word that gets translated to boastful, what he literally wrote is love is not being a windbag. that it implied this idea of self-centered actions. Somebody who exaggerates, who's offensive, and kind of setting himself up as the one who knows it all. He's not simply just bragging. He's focused on his drive to seek status, success, achievement. Of all the hallmarks of the American dream. Right? That this looking out for me first. This word rude. In some translations, it gets translated that love does not dishonor others. Love is not rude to others. It literally means, what he literally wrote was, love does not behave shamefully or disgracefully. That it's indecent behavior. That it dishonors those around this person. That love does not dishonor those it encounters. An example of that happening in the Corinthian church is found in 1 Corinthians 11:22. He wrote to them, "Do you despise the church of God by humiliating those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you? Certainly not in this matter." That Paul is going, your rudeness, your dishonoring of others is revealed in how you treat the poor among you. That there's a list of ways of people groups and people and individuals and different things that they were dishonoring through their actions, and Paul is calling them out on it. Finally, this word proud, which really is kind of the center of all three of these words, isn't it? There's a lot of overlap between all of them. The way it was literally written, what he originally wrote, is love is not puffed up. Right? That this, the way it's used here, and Paul actually uses this word like half a dozen times throughout this letter. This is a reoccurring issue for the Corinthians, that they are puffed up. That they are arrogant. That there is a pride, an opinion of their self and their rightness. An arrogance in their knowledge that has taken it to the point of being sin. That Paul is going, look, to be inflated with pride is the very opposite of love. In 1 Corinthians 8:1, the same word that gets translated proud here gets translated makes us feel important. It's a puffed up idea. In 8:1 he writes, "Yes, we know that, quote, we all have knowledge about this issue, but while knowledge makes us feel important, while knowledge puffs us up, while knowledge creates pride or arrogance, it is love that strengthens the church." Later in that same chapter, verse 11, he says, "So because of your superior knowledge," I feel like he wrote that sarcastically. I don't want to speculate too much. But Paul writes, "So because of your superior knowledge, a weak believer for whom Christ died will be destroyed." See, your pride, your arrogance, is destroying the faith of other people. Your pride is causing damage to others, and you don't even see it. You're so focused on how right you are, how it's got to be your way. Right? That ultimately, pride really is this, is us saying, man, I'm the one that's important. Like, you need to be quiet because this is the way it needs to be. I'm the one that matters. I'm the one that's right. I'm the one with the value. So even if it's at your expense, you need to be quiet because I'm right. And this kind of pride destroys. I can't help but read these verses and flash back to when I was a student at Gordon College, my senior year. I got in a debate with a girl named Alicia over the topic of predestination versus free will. Because that is what Christian college students do for fun. Argue about theological things that in the real world we don't really deal with a whole lot, right? And so we get in this huge argument. And I gotta, look, I gotta level with you, okay? I was winning. Like, here's the deal. She really didn't have a chance, okay? Because, let me recap. I was a pastor's kid. Like, I grew up in a pastor's home. I had a perfect attendance at church, whether I wanted to or not. We went to church on vacation. Right? Like, we just always went. The church was open. We were there. I memorized the most verses in vacation Bible school. I got all the awards. I could win at the sword drill every time. Some of you don't know what that is. We can talk about it later. I'll go over if I do it now. I knew it all. And then I was also a missionary kid. I was homeschooled and I went to private school, Christian schools, right? So I had Bible classes all through middle school and high school. Before I went to Christian college, I went to a Bible college and got a degree in the Bible. And then I went to Gordon. Okay, I'm not saying this the way I say it now, right? Like, this is 20-year-old me speaking, not... I just need to clarify that on a message on pride, right? Get to Gordon. I'm about to graduate with a ministry related degree. I had all the tools. And Alicia, she's nice. But she was studying something else. And she became a Christian. Like, she'd only been a Christian for a couple years at that point. All right? She grew up in a family that didn't follow God. She didn't know anything about it. So I was winning. Like, hands down, it was easy. And it's getting like heated. Because she couldn't see how right I was. And we're like arguing. And here's where I need to mention a clarifying detail that makes me sound worse. Alicia was an orphan. She lost both of her parents at different times as a teenager, one from disease, one from being hit by a car. In hindsight, it's incredible that she came to faith after that. Because she didn't grow up in a home of faith. She didn't grow up with any kind of faith in God. And she lost both of her parents and turned to God. In a culture that generally, even the believers would turn from God. How could you do this to me? Right? And so we're in this argument. And she believes in free will, and I believe we have no will. You know, that God chooses us. God does it, and she's clearly not winning. And finally, she just erupts. She goes, well, I can't believe in a God that chose to send my parents to hell. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. We're just having a fun little debate. Like, I had this moment of just my eyes bugging out and going, I was having a fun argument because I like to win, and she's fighting for whether or not her parents rejected God or God rejected her parents. But I'll never fully know how much my winning hurt her that day. But my knowledge puffed up. I had no sense of empathy. I had no thought of why, what was forming her opinions. What was feeding into where she was at. All I cared about is I needed to be the one that was right. We do that a lot, don't we? The reports are coming out increasingly and increasingly as I read different counseling books and resources. And it just talks about how, as a culture, we don't have empathy. That more and more we lose the ability to put ourselves in the shoes of the person that we're interacting with. That we're so focused on our opinion, how we want it, how we think it should be, my preference. And then we tend to paint things in extremes, right? Somebody has a different opinion of me. I'm not gonna give the way they're phrasing it. I'm gonna paint the extreme version of what they're saying to make them sound crazy because I'm right. You know, my pride doesn't demand not only that I'm right, it demands that they be torn down. And we do this as a culture more and more, and it's so easy as a church, as believers, to get sucked into that trap of pride as well. Our arrogance can lash out when we talk about things like race and racism in America, when we debate equality for women, when we argue about guns, and a thousand other things that push the buttons in our culture and trigger the debates. And part of me wonders how history will look back on us, right? That 55 years ago, last month, in 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. held desegregation rallies in Birmingham, Alabama, which resulted in his arrest. He was incarcerated for it. And while he was in jail, this was the headline in the newspaper: white clergymen urge local Negroes to withdraw from demonstrations. And it was a big, long letter signed by a lot of the local white clergy, essentially saying, just stop it. Like, why are you causing a big scene? You're causing all sorts of unnecessary conflict. They literally ended it with an appeal for common sense. And Martin Luther King Jr. wrote a few days later in a letter responding to it, in the midst of this one line really jumped out at me. In the midst of blatant injustices inflicted upon the Negro, I have watched white churches stand on the sideline and merely mouth pious irrelevancies and sanctimonious trivialities. Whoa. And here's the thing. Here's why I think about that. Because today, you'd be hard-pressed to find someone that says Martin Luther King Jr. was not a great man. Right? We all see it now. We see his legacy and his impact and his wisdom and how he drove change for good. He was incredibly provocative at the time. People did not like him. It resulted in his assassination. You know, that it hit me earlier this year. Martin Luther King died at a younger age than I am now. That kind of dinged my pride a little bit. I was like, well, he accomplished a lot. But there's a little bit of a, now that we no longer have a personal connection to what was happening 55 years ago, it's very easy for us to objectively look back and go, why were people reacting that way? And yet I wonder if he would say some of the same words today, looking at racial relationships in the U.S. You know, do minority voices still feel, do they feel like they have the freedom yet to talk about what the experience is genuinely like with their white Christian brothers and sisters? That when we talk about things like unequal pay and treatment in the workplace for women, it's not unusual to hear comments like, I just saw in an interview recently where someone said something to the effect of, these women, they don't know how good they have it. Why don't they go to a country where they really suffer? And then see if they want to complain. And which is such a bizarre logic, right? Like, as though you have no right to complain about an injustice. That something is not wrong as long as you can find it worse somewhere else. Right? Like, if you went to your boss because you were way overdue for a raise, you put in the time, you put in the work, you knew you deserved it, and you went in to request a raise, and he said to you, look, man, I'm sorry, but are you aware that Nicaraguans work for 10 hours a day in the sugarcane fields for a dollar or two a day? That's the average income, and you're going to come in here and complain about what you're making? Like, we know that doesn't translate. We get that just because something is worse somewhere else doesn't make it right here. That when we talk about issues, a few weeks ago, I got so mad. A friend of mine, I have to phrase it right to make sure you see the connection, because it's a lot of... on April 22nd, the Waffle House shooting that happened in Tennessee, one of my friends has a son who is friends with one of the people that was killed that day. So my friend posted on Facebook that night, it really brings it home. It really brings the gun debate home when it affects your own household. And then he posted some comments about how this young man was a friend of his son, and his son was grieving. And immediately, and here's the thing, this is a youth pastor. These were the youth pastors. Immediately started ripping into him about, don't you dare go after the Second Amendment, don't you dare do that. Like, just raging over the gun debate issue. And I was furious going, is nobody even stopping for a moment to think this man is grieving that his son is experiencing a grief that he shouldn't have to experience? Regardless of which side of the argument you fall on, there was no empathy for the human pain going on in that moment. That pride demanded, no, it needs to be this way now. These words that we looked at, describing boasting, proud or rude, windbag, offensive, shameful, dishonoring others, to be puffed up with arrogance, to me they characterize so much of what we see today. Doesn't it? That characterizes so much of what we can fall into, whether we intend to or not. Peter Enns wrote, it is so easy to slip into right thinking mode that we have arrived at full faith. We know what church God goes to, what Bible translation God prefers, how God votes, what movies God watches, and what books God reads. We know the kinds of people God approves of. God has winners and losers, and we are the winners, the true insiders. God likes all the things we like. We speak for God and think nothing of it. You see, the Corinthians were exactly that. They forgot that we're all God's children. They put their pride in the wrong thing. I was talking with my wife about this earlier this week, and she made the comment, it was so right, that it wasn't, the problem wasn't that they had pride. Their problem was their pride was in the wrong thing. They put their pride in their arrogance, that they knew how it needed to be and everybody else needed to be quiet and line up. All right, what their pride should have been is that they were created in the image of God, that they were children of God, that they get to emulate Christ. In Genesis 1, 26 through 27, it talks about how every single one of us is created in the image of God. When we begin to think about that, every single person we encounter is in the image of God, is bearing the image of God, what kind of value does that communicate to those people? Then in Romans 3:23, it talks about how all of us have sinned. That nobody is somehow ahead of the curve. That in God's eyes, we're all equally in need of God. There is no room for pride or arrogance of, I'm better, I'm more superior, I know the right answers. That Christ-like love is a sacrificial love. That it's dying to ourself, that it's dying to our own pride, that it's putting someone else first. That it's sacrificing what I prefer, sometimes even at my own expense, for the benefit of someone else. In Matthew chapter 5, in a context of teaching about love, Jesus gave some examples of what love looks like. And one of them was, he said, if somebody makes you go a mile, go a second mile. Which to us, like a mile is nothing. I'll drive my car a mile. The day I got my license was the last day I walked or rode my bike anywhere. I know, you can't tell. But in the culture back then, 2,000 years ago, the Jewish people were a conquered people. The Christians were a conquered people. The Roman Empire was over everyone. And Roman soldiers had the right to grab anyone, regardless of what they were doing, and make them carry their gear for a mile. This was humiliating. Right? We can't overemphasize, whatever you were doing, whatever your agenda was, whatever appointment you needed to get to, whatever work you were trying to do, whatever it was, you needed to drop it and walk a mile. Which really meant now you're 2 miles out of your way because you've got to walk a mile back. After carrying this soldier's gear who conquered you and is part of keeping you enslaved, which for the Jews was not only just frustrating, it was religiously offensive. And Jesus says, hey, love is going a second mile. Like, you get to the end of that mile and you tell the soldier, hey, I'd like to serve you for another mile, sir. And keep going. Now you're out 4 miles. Right? But that's the opposite of pride. Because pride would say, aren't you thinking about my schedule? Aren't you thinking about what's important to me? Aren't you thinking about my day? You're going to make me carry your stuff? And love says, how can I serve? How can I help you? How can I put you first? Where is love calling you to sacrifice pride? That I think for all of us, there's probably something somewhere in this that God is pricking your heart. That pride is just one of those easiest sins for each of us to fall into. And the overwhelming thing is to say, so don't ever be proud ever again. Beat it, conquer it, get your whole life in order. Let me know how it is. No, that's overwhelming. Right, let's set a different goal. Whatever it is that's pricking in your heart right now, that God's bringing to your attention, an area in your life where God is going, hey, there's some pride there you need to deal with. It might be with your spouse. It might be with your boss, a fellow employee, a classmate, a teammate, a friend. There might be a situation where you need to admit you were wrong, and we do not like to do that. We feel like we're admitting weakness when we admit we're wrong, and yet, don't we have the most respect for people that can own up to stuff, that can admit and acknowledge? Don't we respect all those positive attributes of love? Isn't that what we look for in others? Do you need to let go of the need to be perfect? Do you need to let go of the need to have a perfect reputation with other people at the church? Is your pride preventing you from reaching out for help in some area that you need help, but it would mean acknowledging something going on? Do you need to learn to empathize better, to respond differently in your conversations or social media or interactions? I would challenge you to commit now, in whatever that thing is that's coming to your mind, to do something about it. Don't put it off till tomorrow or later this week. Send a text to that person. Hey, I need to have a conversation with you. When can we meet? You know, make a note to yourself. I need to, you know, maybe it's reaching out to someone. Hey, I need help. When can we talk about it? Do it now while the moment is fresh, because it's easy for our pride to talk ourselves out of it. I want to close with this thought from N.T. Wright. Writing about 1 Corinthians 13, he said, the point of 1 Corinthians 13 is that love is not our duty. It is our destiny. It is the language Jesus spoke, and we are called to speak it so that we can converse with him. It's the food they eat in God's new world, and we must acquire the taste for it here and now. It is the music God has written for all his creatures to sing, and we are called to learn it and practice it now so as to be ready when the conductor brings down his baton. It is the resurrection life. And the resurrected Jesus calls us to begin living it with him and for him now. Love is at the very heart of the surprise of hope. People who truly hope, as the resurrection encourages us to hope, will be people enabled to love in a new way. Conversely, people who are living by this rule of love will be people who are learning more deeply how to hope. Let's pray. Heavenly Father,